Well, I'm actually bound to disappoint you because I'm not here to talk about software, not even about technology. I'm here to talk about power and about freedom. And I have a millennium to talk about and about 18 minutes to do it, maybe even less, if I want to do us all a favor and get us into lunch a bit early. So take a deep breath now, all together. Relax. Go. Knowledge has always been the key to power. What you see here is the Library of Alexandria, once one of the seven wonders of the world, then burnt down by a bunch of ignorance. Now re-erected. I went there last year and the shelves weren't quite full yet, but there's lots of space to go there, lots of knowledge to be accumulated. It wasn't always that way. About 1,000 years ago, knowledge in the form of books, at least, was concentrated in the hands of an extremely small elite. Only monks could read and write, and even only a few of those, only men of the church. Not even kings, like this gentleman, whom a few of you might know from the region, Charlemagne, who was one of the few people who actually espoused the idea of learning to read and write around the year 800. However, I'm not sure, did he actually make it? Does anyone know? Could Charlemagne read and write? Okay, someone go to Wikipedia, please. Anyway, this was reflected in the way that power in those societies at that time was set up. The structure of knowledge reflected the structure of power. You have a huge central, or actually a rather small central, powerful core that controls everything, like a king, a monarch, a bishop, and the rest of the people are just people. They don't have any power at all, really. That changed thanks to this gentleman and a few others. It's a touchy subject to bring up in a Catholic stronghold like Heerlen, but Martin Luther's translation of the Bible from Latin into vernacular German, and the trend it triggered for similar translations into other languages, was instrumental in distributing power away from the centralized system of the church into a slightly more decentralized setup. That was supercharged by the arrival of a new technology, the printing press. Around 1450, when Gutenberg in Mainz, Germany, well outside the Eutropolis region, unfortunately, started using the printing press in movable type to print what today we know as books. That, today, together with what today we would call content of the translated Bible, the Reformation, led to a huge increase in printed works. It meant that the structure of knowledge changed very rapidly, unlike my slides. What you see here is Newton's Philosophiae Naturalis de Principia Mathematica, so one of Newton's main works. It reflects the change in the system of the university, away from the scholastic system that was bound or limited to studying the classics of the Romans and the Greeks. Romans, by the way, being, I think, the same ones who burned down the library in Alexandria, and towards today's academic system that strives for logic and for reason, and for all its defects, has brought us great benefits. As the structure of knowledge changed, as more people, or actually for the first time, a significant number of people were able to hold in their hands printed works, and a significant number of people were able to publish their works in significant numbers thanks to the printing press that had become established thanks to the Reformation and the huge demand for content it provided. That led to political changes, to pressure for the change in power and to demands for fundamental freedom. This is a pamphlet by John Milton from 1644, where he talks to the English Parliament about the need for freedom of the press. That press. Until that time, and for about 50 years after, you needed a license in Britain to operate a printing press, and it stayed like that for a couple more centuries in many other places. if you wanted to distribute knowledge in any significant numbers, you needed to ask your government for permission. But even with all those legal changes, constitutions, the demands for fundamental freedoms led to constitutions that limit the power of kings and define the freedoms of the citizen. Even with all those changes, the paradigm has stayed much the same for about the last, well, since Gutenberg and Luther, really. Because, again, we have a number, this time a bigger number of large organizations that are able to produce, to write content, to write ideas and knowledge in very large numbers, and to distribute it. But not everyone used to have that same ability. That goes for the printing press. This is a slightly more modern one, I think from around 1920. So newspapers, books, to things like radio, the music industry, the movie industry. Every time you think of these organizations, TV stations, it becomes clear that you need a relatively large investment in terms of capital to set one up. And in the case of TV and radio stations, you even need permission from your government. Sound familiar? So the paradigm of having a few large organizations that were able to pull in that capital and that were able to get those permissions from the government and still retain some freedom to act, that was a limited number. It's unchanged. Nevertheless, people all through the time have recognized the fundamental importance of being able to read and to write. This is a photo from 2 years ago, taken in Afghanistan. Women in a literacy class. So being able to manage knowledge in a sovereign way means being able to read it, being able to write and to distribute, or actually, well, that's my third point, to distribute, to publish. The paradigm only started changing very, very recently within all our lifetimes. Anyone under 5 in the room? The network computer, the progress is not the coffee or the bagels, donut, that's older. The network computer really represents a big progress in terms of how we can communicate, how we can access knowledge, and how we can distribute knowledge. But what do computers run on? Computers run on software. A computer is a universal machine, a program. A particular program turns it into a specific machine. And you need software to do that. Actually, most source code I've looked at doesn't look that bad. Still, in the digital realm, code is law. You can break the law when you walk outside. You can choose to cross the street on a red light. And you might face the consequences. There might be no consequences. A policeman might catch you and fine you 10 euros, or this being the Netherlands, probably more like 50. I remember getting a speeding ticket from Heerlen here, the route around that looks like you can drive 120 and you're only allowed 70. Now, but in cyberspace, in the digital realm, anything that's code, software code, is a law that cannot be broken. You can cross the street on a red light, but you can't make use of an option in a program that simply isn't there. If the program says you can't write to a USB key outside the main computer, then that's the law. You can't break it. Unless you have the source code and the freedom to change it. Let it not be forgotten. Source code is merely the human readable form of a program. It's the form in which programs are written and read. This is a program to calculate the distance between two points on a plane. And if you look at it for a while, it becomes pretty clear how it does that, but it's not really important. The important thing is this, the difference between the two. This is the executable code, the binary code, the code that the computer looks at. That is so much harder to change, to understand even. And in order to change it, you need to understand it. With the source code, I can say, well, it says distance somewhere up here. So this might have, okay, it's probably distance, then there's an x distance and a y distance, and you subtract something from the other, and okay, that'll probably do the trick. But with the executable code, I have no idea. I hear there are some people who actually make a hobby of reading this kind of stuff, but hobbies. Anyway, in order to, I mentioned the fundamental importance of being able to read, to write, and to publish. What does that translate to in terms of software? It translates into four fundamental freedoms that we all need to claim and demand with regard to software. You didn't notice I'm cheating you. I'm talking about software anyway, right? So the first freedom is the freedom to use the program for any purpose. Because, well, if someone gives you, or if you have a tool, if you choose to take your screwdriver and bang a nail into the wall with it, it's not the most effective way, but why keep you from doing it? It doesn't hurt anybody, except maybe yourself. The freedom to study the program, to look at how it works, to understand how it works, and to understand how programs like this are actually made. Now, if I ever need to calculate the distance between two points on a plane, I'm going to look at that source code I showed you a second ago to see how it's done. And then even, I think there's probably C language, even if I'm going to do it in the Java programming language or somewhere else, I will still need to subtract point one from point zero. So that's what I can learn from the source code. Another important thing, it's a bit more complex, but we need to be able to share the program. We need to be able to pass it on. When my neighbor comes down to my house and asks me, "Hey, Karsten, can you lend me a hammer?" I say, "Sure," and not just because he's my landlord, but simply because I'm a nice guy. And he goes and uses the hammer for whatever, and I don't care, and he returns it to me, and that's all I ask. With the program, making copies doesn't cost anything. So if my neighbor asks me, "Karsten, can I use your tax program because I need to do my taxes?" I say, "Yeah, sure." And in many cases, that's from a moral, from an ethical standpoint, that's exactly the correct response. Why wouldn't I help my neighbor if I have a tool? Now, from a legal standpoint, it can be exactly the wrong response. If you use non-free software that doesn't give you these freedoms, these three and the next one I'm going to talk about, then you're committing an illegal act because you're handing out a copy of something that you shouldn't have copied, that you're not authorized to copy, and that you promised not to copy. But if you use free software, you can actually do that and not break the law. And you need to be able, the fourth freedom, to improve the software, to adapt it to your own needs, and to take those improvements and give them to your neighbor or give them to anyone else who asks, if you want to. Maybe you can charge for the privilege, but that's what you want to be able to do. These are the four freedoms that define free software. Any program, regardless, totally doesn't matter the technology of the program, if the legal conditions on the program give you these four freedoms, it's free software, and it falls into my remit then. Just a very quick bit of history. It's on about the same speed scale as we sped through the last eight centuries. Free software, in the beginning, all software was free because it simply came as a sort of operating manual with huge mainframes that universities and big companies bought. At the end of the 70s, people started locking down software because they thought it was a good way to make money off it. Now, that irked some people so much that they started the project to write a free operating system that gave you these four freedoms. It was known as the GNU project in the mid-80s, for GNUs, not Unix. And it went almost to being complete at the early 90s. The only thing missing was the part that talked to the hardware, which is today the Linux kernel. So a Finnish student named Linus Torvalds came up with the idea of writing a kernel for an operating system and put it out there on the internet. And it got picked up and integrated into the GNU system. Perhaps many of you know the Firefox web browser, which is sort of symbolizes the rise of free software over the past 25 years, from a small hobbyist pursuit of a few academics to something that's quite important in global terms. According to an estimate by the Gartner consultancy, about 100% of companies now use free software. Actually, I checked this event's website, and it's running on free software as well, free software web server Apache on a GNU Linux system. So what a coincidence. And the free software ecosystem, according to the Linux Foundation, is going to be worth next year about $50 billion US dollars. Those are very substantial sums. Nothing compared to a stimulus program in the US, but anyway. So that's the basic of free software. And there the idea was to free the user on his or her computer. But we have a slightly different setting today. Computers are networked in a huge way. And so the question is, who owns the equivalent of the printing press? This is Google's Blogger service. If you want to open a blog and you don't want to bother with any of the technology, you simply go there, create an account, your blog is there. Great. This, I could have picked a better picture, but it has a fancy logo too, but this is the WordPress blogging software, perhaps the most frequently used software for hosting blogs on your own server. What's the difference? This one involves a bit of work, not much, but you need to do some setup and you need to figure out how it works or get someone to do it for you. This one is just very easy to sign up. Doesn't cost you anything either. But this one has terms of service. This one doesn't. With a Blogger service, you have to respect certain conditions under which you can use the service. And those conditions may be liberal, or they may be changed at any moment, but they're definitely not under your control. Your blog can be taken down by someone at, in this case, Google, because they don't like it, and you can't really do anything about it. With the WordPress software that runs on your own computer, you determine what you do there. So we go from a system that is structured around a few large organizations, what should we call it? The 15th century system? The old paradigm? No, old paradigms, there's enough of those around. You go to a set of messy slides. No, there are more services like this. Google Docs works like that. Facebook works like that. If you have your social network on Facebook, that's all very well, and I guess it works pretty well, but your social network really belongs to Facebook. They can choose to turn it off at any time or change the interface, which tends to trigger huge debates for people who apparently can't feel passionate about anything else. With things like WordPress, you move to a model like this, a peer-to-peer model, where there are no central nodes, where there are only equals. Now, do those things actually exist? Am I talking about science fiction? No. They're maybe not as well known, but there's things like Jabber, which is an instant messaging system. You can set up your own server of that, if you have a computer that runs on network, you can install a Jabber server, and you'll be able to chat with pretty much anyone on pretty much any protocol. The two below here are, programmers might know them, they're source code management systems. This one, StatusNet, is an interesting case. It started out as a Twitter clone. Now, clone is perhaps the wrong word, because the decisive difference is you can take StatusNet, install it on your own server, and it will instantly link up with all the other StatusNet instances out there. You can send messages to them. The company StatusNet runs a service called Identica, which works much like Twitter, but differently. Well, Twitter has investment. StatusNet has revenue. They're actually making money, because Twitter still hasn't figured out how to do that. StatusNet says, well, if you're a company, you're a large company, and you want an internal thing like Twitter, we'll do it for you, and we'll send you an invoice to do it. So these distributed, or peer-to-peer systems, rather, they, in my eyes, need to fulfill a few conditions to be actually fulfill that promise of letting all of us read and write and publish in freedom. They need to run on free software according to those four freedoms that I showed you, to use, study, share, and improve the software. They need to interconnect using open standards so that no one can tell you, no, you can't link to my service because I don't like your face. Or you need to pay me a lot of money. No, it just needs to work like that, out of the box. And they need to allow for this peer-to-peer design for distributed local instances. Now, who pays for all those servers if we have our distributed systems? Google or Facebook make money from advertisement. That's fair enough. But if we build a distributed system, how will we pay for the service and the bandwidth? we can do it, for example, it's just an example, each one on their own. What you see here, no, this is not the power plug of that one. That, on the left, is a router, but it's a router that has had its software, its firmware, in that case, modified. It runs a free operating system, and it works as a server, a small one. So it's something that just takes your internet traffic out to the world and works as a server without consuming any additional power, and since we all have flat rates, the bandwidth doesn't really matter. This one is called the Shiva plug. It's a very small server as well. It's basically just a USB stick, an Ethernet plug, an external USB connection, and a power connection. And a tiny bit of software, the GNU Linux operating system runs on there. And you can use it to set up, to run basically anything you want to run on a server. Now, my project for the next 5 years that I want to get everybody involved in is to take that hardware and to take the software that I mentioned before, those distributed systems, and create a package that I can just give you and you and you and say, plug it in, enter your name, create a username and password, and you have a homepage, you have a blog, you have a Jabber instance, you have a Twitter-like thing going, and you're linked to everybody else who has the same. That will be a free infrastructure. And it won't cost you really much. The router goes on eBay for about 60 euros, I think. The plug costs about $100, last I checked. So we would move from a system where a few large companies host our services for us and host it at their discretion to a system like this. It's not so much about the architecture of knowledge. It's about the architecture of power. Who gets to determine whom we can tell what, when, in which way? In that system, these guys do. In this system, we all do. So, choose. Make your choice. Which system do you want to back? You're creating the digital environment. Which setup do you want? Which world do you want to live in? Which world do you want your children to live in? And when you've chosen freedom, join us at the URLs below. Thanks. Thank you.